Hi, I'm Ben.
And I'm Zach.
Welcome to the Movie Vault. Today, as you may well know, we are covering the second in a trilogy of movies by Sergio Leone. And this one is For a Few Dollars More. As I mentioned 2 seconds ago, this movie was directed by Sergio Leone. And it stars Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef. The soundtrack is done by Ennio Morricone, and other people were in this movie that were also in the last movie, including Gian Maria Volente, who I think is the most memorable of the people in the last movie, as well as probably a couple of the other bandits involved in the movie. This movie is not exactly the same as the first in the Dollars trilogy. Instead, it stars Clint Eastwood as a guy who people reference as Manco. And he's a bounty killer. Not a bounty hunter, a bounty killer. Mm. It's very important. I guess it's kind of the same thing, but they kill people. And he goes and he is sort of competing for customers, if you will, with a certain former army officer named Colonel Douglas Mortimer. But Mortimer's intentions are a little bit more personal, as we'll find out. So, before I get started, I'd like to remind you as a listener to follow us at the Movie Vault Podcast on Instagram and at the Movie Vault. No, it's at the Movie Vault Pod on Instagram, but you'd probably find it either way. And then at Movie Vault Pod on Twitter. Email us at themovievaultpod@gmail.com.
We have a MySpace coming up too.
Yeah, we have a huge launch date for the MySpace. Mm-hmm. I'm actually curious if the MySpace still exists. But anyway, Zach, what were your initial?
Yeah, my initial thoughts were it is not like the first movie, like people say. I think it's very different. I think in the first movie, one thing that we said, wow, it still exists, MySpace. Okay, I think the first thing that I thought was. In the first movie, in A Fistful of Dollars, we see our main character, the man with no name, Joe, whatever you want to call him, Manco. And then we'll also hear him as Blondie in the third, in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. This man, he's always in control, and he's always knowing what to do in every situation. He is just almost omnipotent in every single scene in the first film. True. So in this scene, or in this film, he's really nothing like that at all. He's being helped the entire time. He kind of learns a little lesson in there that he needs other people. So yeah, I liked that, showing a different aspect of the same character. Sergio did a good job of showing that. And then also, like, I think some of the action in this was a lot better. I think the gunshots were very were probably more unrealistic, but were still fun. And then I think it was fun that they brought back the same actor. You can remind me of his name, but the same actor for Ramon. Right,
Gian Maria Volente.
Yeah. So they brought him back for what's his name, Indio, in this film. So I mean, that was great. Just the same chemistry that they had in the first one, they brought back to this one. This was made only a year after that one. That was 1964. This is 1965, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is 1966. So it's interesting to see how fast these turnarounds were, but also like how high quality these are. Like, once again, the soundtrack is amazing. I think the whistling, and we were laughing throughout the film at different parts where just some random sound effects were played, like boy yo 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 yo, just in the middle of like random intense scenes. And it, for us, it didn't fit because we're used to hearing those in like kooky situations, because we've satirized this genre, right? This spaghetti western type of movie. But really, back in the day, it's like people took that seriously. So yeah. I enjoyed it. And you know, the music added to every single scene. So really, like, I think that stood out again to me the most. But Clint Eastwood, of course, Clint Eastwood at the forefront. you know, seeing him have to act out the same character from the first one, who's almost emotionless, but have him act out like, you know, uncertainty. Probably there was some uncertainty in his face in many of these scenes when what is the other guy, Mortimer, that's right, yes. Mortimer, when Mortimer, you know, he's helping him throughout this entire time, and you can tell he's way more skilled. You learn that in the first scene when they have the standoff and they shoot each other's hats, which is awesome. So it's just their dynamic was great. Because he doesn't even have a dynamic in the first film.
So no.
I think that addition was pleasant, I guess.
Yeah. He still keeps his sort of mysterious nature about him, but he is a little bit more humanized because of his interaction with Mortimer. Because he has to, like, interact with somebody like a normal human and, like, compromise and, like, make a deal. He's not just trying to screw over somebody. Although, I guess in the first movie, he sort of has that human compassion aspect, but he never really even interacts with the people that he saves in the first movie.
True.
So,
there's that. And it's fun because everybody's still going after money in this film, you know? No matter who they are. But at the end of the day, Mortimer is almost the good guy of this film, as he's really just seeking revenge, even though, you know, revenge might not be technically the best, but he's seeking revenge for his sister that he lost, which we find out at the end. So, I mean, it's a touching story, and it's easy to figure out pretty early on, but it's still great. That's why reveals don't have to be crazy.
Again, it's a simple story. They give you some hints along the way. If you want to figure it out, you probably could. If you want to just go along with the story and figure out, see what happens at the end. Some of it's a little confusing because they just, like, cut to random things, and you're left like, oh, you're like, who's this guy again? Like, I don't remember. But other than that, it's a fairly simple story. It starts out just with Mortimer and Manco both being introduced, both getting some bad guys, cashing in a couple $1,000s. But it's pretty clear they want to go after this guy named Indio, who's worth $10,000 if they kill him. And they figure out pretty quickly that he wants to rob the Bank of El Paso, which is El Paso, Texas, at this time is much smaller than it is right now. Right now it's 678,000 people, and it's the 22nd largest city in the United States. This version of El Paso appeared to be about maybe 100, 200 people, and it was one row of places, and there's two competing hotels, so I guess there's enough people coming through that they need two hotels. And quickly, we see there's a lot of hustlers in this town. This little guy tries to get 50 cents out of Manco every time he asks for information. Eventually, Manco just makes him give him information, but it's still interesting to see that the personalities that are involved in this place.
It's interesting because in the first film, that the same thing happened, but it was an adult. Not that the kid-adult thing matters, but it's literally the same thing. So there are a lot of elements of this film that were the same.
They go into the saloons, like, they make friends with some people in the town. There's some kind of, like, weird parts where, like, there's that, like, really short guy and the girl who, like, clearly is into him but's married to this, like, I don't know.
Was it to him or no?
Yeah, I think that was what was implied. Yeah. There's a lot of, kind of implication satire.
That was adding a funny part into this.
Yeah, they added some humor. They lengthened. It was about 30 minutes longer, so they lengthened, I think, some of those aspects of humor. They added more characters overall. Mm-hmm. Like, it just felt like the towns that they went to, the places they went to, were, like, lived in instead of just being so isolated. Mm-hmm. And they weren't always in one location. So that was kind of a change. Supposedly, El Paso's bank was super strong, but fortunately for El Indio, he had ran into the guy who made it was like a wardrobe that...
Yeah, it was like a covering for the safe.
For the safe. So it was like maybe there was like a safe that was kind of a decoy safe, and then there was this real safe that was within a wooden box that you wouldn't suspect, but they still had a guard by it. But somehow they were able to use explosives. I think they blew up the outside of the building is what we determined.
But also that, you're right though. That doesn't make a lot of sense because the explosion went outward.
Yeah. I thought, so they got this little box. Didn't they actually steal from the guy who made the...
Talking about the carpenter?
The carpenter. I thought they actually stole from the carpenter. Like, remember that one scene? They go into this house and they steal that, like, wooden box thing.
Yeah.
I thought the implication was that was the carpenter. I could be wrong.
Oh.
And so then I was like, did that box have, like, he had already rigged explosives into the cabinet? I don't know. It seemed a little...
interesting why a carpenter would have that on him.
It seemed a little... That seemed like a little bit of a stretch to me, but I was the only thing I could make up.
Was the carpenter was still in prison.
Yeah, because he was saying it like it was a story that almost didn't even happen, like a pretend story.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, it's real. And then there's some random stuff. Like they just threw in this guy who, Manco, like breaks out of prison just to gain trust.
That was his brother, I think,
Oh, it was his brother. I didn't
right? Or
realize
something
that.
like that. They loved each other.
Yeah, they were very close friends at the least. And
If not, you know, related.
if not related. And so I guess that gains the trust of Indio. And then Manco, I keep calling him Banco. Manco is used as a distraction with three other guys with the weird cut in the middle of the movie where it's just like they're in one scene and they're talking about him leaving with the three guys. And then all of a sudden the music just stops, it fades to black. And then he's sitting there with the three guys. And then he just shoots the three guys. And you're like, how was this part of the plan? Which it probably wasn't. Because. And then he goes to the bank at Santa Cruz that they're distracting him and says, just call him and tell him there was a robbery. Then
That
that's when the actual bank robbery happens.
that's where you can see that it was made when in 1 year,
Yeah.
you know.
Like some of the plot stuff is like a little convoluted.
My favorite, one of my favorite parts, and we both laughed at this, was when they're like, "This is the agua caliente, right?" Or not
Yeah.
caliente, whatever the other word.
Yeah.
Caliente is hot, but something else. And he goes, then they're like, "Well, we have to go there." And then all of a sudden, they're like, "Welcome to agua
It's like
caliente!" Like right
it's like
away,
just phase.
it was like it didn't even fade. It just literally changed the scene.
Then I think it was the dialogue that they just repeated
They're
basically.
like, "We have to go to agua caliente or whatever. Welcome to," but there's no fade to black. I just thought it was funny.
That was no, it is agua caliente.
Oh, hot water. I said it wrong
Yeah.
earlier. I thought it was calm water. Tranquilo. Okay.
Yeah. So and there's and then Indio eventually tries to screw over the people who work for him by set, like, releasing they catch Manco and Mortimer. They figure out that they're bounty hunters and then Indio tries to release them and get his men to go after them so he can run away with the money. But one of his guys, Groggy, realizes what's up and kills Nino and then forces Indio to open the strong box, which there's nothing in because I actually don't know why there's nothing in it. Did somebody else steal it at some point? Oh no, the money was with the bounty hunters because
Yeah, they put it in their
they put it in
bags
the
when they
bags.
were planning to
Yeah,
escape.
yeah. So then they just sit there until Mortimer and
Would be the best if the
Manco come
prophet
back.
just the prophet just had all the
Yeah.
money. He's just running away. He's like, "These darn trains."
I think the thing we really learned from the movie is that the trains are the worst thing that happened to this country.
They made the kids bad. They made
Yeah.
the they brought in the bounty hunters.
Zach and I just thought it was very funny because nowadays when you hear people complaining about technology, you just realize that like back then they still thought like technology was the
Yeah,
reason
like
that.
trains are old to us now.
Yeah, like that's ancient news.
Sure. You know, when paper was invented, people thought it was like terrible. You know, I mean, not really, but what's something that you think was invented that people
Like
thought was sane?
hygiene, people probably thought when
Like
they
brushing your teeth?
that's terrible.
That's elevating yourself above nature.
Above nature.
I don't know.
Yeah, but
But
people could always complain about the means of
toothpaste? I don't trust that.
technological
It's
growth.
gonna make my kids
And
be
now
born
people are
with
saying
two
like
heads.
AI, I don't trust that. Like what? Like come on.
Yeah, I don't
It's
know.
gonna be fine.
I don't know. Maybe AI will be our best friends in the future.
Yeah, maybe they'll be better friends than our actual friends. I
Yeah.
don't
Yeah. It's not hard to beat. But my, like for me as a friend.
I guess I feel like the thing about AI friends is they will more likely just tell you back what you want to hear, which isn't probably really what you
Unless
want to
you
hear.
program it to like fight back a little bit.
Fight back a little, just enough to feel like a real human, but not too much.
Just enough to be like, "Oh, Alexa, come on."
It's fine. Yeah, but
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend this, but. Anyway, that's I'm coughing like I just smoked
you
all the
good?
cigar
Oh my
or the
gosh.
cigarettes that they
There's
smoked
so
in
many
this movie.
smoking scenes.
It, the pipe that Mortimer has. Yeah, that's another thing. Smoking was I think well Clint Eastwood's still alive, but he seems like he smoked a lot in this movie. And we think it's real like real cigarette smoke that they were smoking in the movies.
I mean, it wasn't CGI.
I have no proof of that. Yeah, it was definitely not CGI. All practical effects.
I always thought, you know, the practical effects in this were amazing, by the way, but
except for some of the punching and shooting. But other than that, they were amazing.
The punching was bad. The punching was bad. But this is something that I've just been thinking about in the last two movies, is that the way that men, like, approach each other is, like, nobody talks. Someone, like, pinches someone and sees the reaction, you know? And everybody's watching. You know what I mean? Like, he goes up, takes his cigarette, uses it to light his pipe. Like, they're just not, they don't talk, and they just do something. Like, go up, step on your shoe.
Right. You know? Shoot your hat. Yeah. Do something.
Shoot your cigar.
You don't really know what it is. You don't know how you should react to it, but everyone's just testing everybody.
Yeah, it's just interesting, you know? That's how it was.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays we'll, like, slander each other's mothers, but yeah. Back then they would step on each other's shoes. It's almost respectful.
Yeah.
It's almost like, well, we talked about this too. Like, there's this hidden norm that we don't really know about, societal norm for them, that they follow these rules. When they're in a standoff, they don't shoot before it's time, before the music ends. Like, when somebody sets the rules, you follow them. And that's, to me, that's, as a postmodern raised and born, I don't really know what to think about that. You know, I would just shoot. If he killed, you know, my sister, I would shoot when the song's playing while he doesn't think I'm going to shoot him.
Yeah, why would I wait?
I don't know.
I think maybe for Mortimer, it's like more satisfaction, because then he kills him. Like, I don't know. Like, there's something about that. Mortimer wants he wants the revenge. He wants to kill Indio. And he almost doesn't, but he gets bailed out by Manco. But Manco still lets him have his moment.
Well, it's good because he saved him like two or three times.
Yeah.
And then Manco comes back.
Yeah. So. This is the first time that Manco actually looks like, that there's somebody who's actually smarter than him.
And that's good. I love that.
And it's his elder, so that makes sense.
He calls him old man.
Yeah.
But what do you think he's trying to learn? What do you think the moral for Manco is?
For Manco, does he learn anything? I don't know. I guess maybe a little bit to just respect his elders and to work as a team with someone.
Yeah, it's working as a team.
You're working as a team.
Because at the beginning, you know, they meet each other and they're talking about their alliance or partnership. And he's like, well, then, you know, he's asking him, like, well, what's the question that you're... He asked him, like, something about a question that's personal. Like, why do you not think that a guy should be alone? And he's like, well, it's not the question that's... I forget what the word was. It's not the question, but it's the answer. So I think he's implying that, no, there are personal connections that matter. He was referring to his sister, obviously. But Manco didn't know that at the time, but Manco could tell at the end that he was going after revenge, especially when he didn't want the money. So I think Manco could tell that, and I think he learned that, like, no, you do need other people sometimes, especially when his life was saved so many times by Mortimer. Or was it
Mortimer?
Mortimer.
Like Richard and Mortimer.
Sure.
Yeah. So we had a couple of topics. So the first obvious thing to cover is, like, how does the first and second movie in this series compare? So Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More, which have names that can be easily mixed up because they both have dollars in them.
Hmm.
There are some similarities, but in my head, they still seem like very different movies.
Yeah, there are different movies, yeah.
Like, I was expecting, I think, it to be a little bit more similar. In a sense.
Yeah, I mean, when you see the cast, it seems the same, right? You have the crazy guy trying to be a prophet. You have the same villain, literally, pretty much. And you have all these bandits as well. And then this literally the same man with no name character. But it's a different story with more complexity, I'd say. I don't know why I said it like that. More complexity. And there are extra layers, more characters, more backdrops as well.
Yeah. I think there's, like, more defined roles. Like, we know Manco is a bounty killer. We really don't know what Manco is in the first movie, or what is he referred to in the first movie? Joe. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just a stranger, you know? He's not really anybody.
Now, we are supposed to assume that this movie takes place before Fistful of Dollars.
Does that make sense? Obviously, we have to remove that some of the cast is the same, because that'll start to make things confusing, because obviously this guy can't be Ramon Rojo. Like, they have to be two actual different
people. Or it could be his dad. True. This takes place 10 years later.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Or his brother, his identical twin brother. That might be more likely.
That's true. Yeah, it could be a twin brother. Well, they had a lot of brothers, though, the Rojos.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be three brothers. Maybe there's a fourth that they didn't know about.
Yeah. So, but do you think, like, from a character development standpoint, it makes sense that he went through this story before he went through A Fistful of Dollars?
I'm not sure, because I'm not sure if he's not a loner in the Fistful of Dollars, if he learned that, because I truly do think that that's the moral of his story. I don't think it's the main focus of the movie. I think that that's what Sergio challenges Joe, or what Mark Manco, to do. But he seems to be the same guy in both movies. A little bit cocky, arrogant, you know, knows what he's doing usually. But no, I don't think it makes sense character-wise. Story-wise, sure. You couldn't not. What would be against
it? Fistful of Dollars feels more like a side quest. And maybe in a way, he does seem a little bit more confident, or like, since he and he's confident in A Fistful of Dollars, yet he never, it's not until the end where he really gets the upper hand in many situations. Whereas in for A Fistful of Dollars, he is always confident and always basically wins in every scenario. So maybe it does follow that he like learned some things from Mortimer and became, and maybe it was just that like the people he was going up against were not as difficult to manage either, because it was more contained than for A Few Dollars More.
You're definitely right, yeah. But yeah, there really isn't any evidence against them being in this, you know, in a chronological order. So that's the fun part about it being loosely connected, is that you can do fun things like these and still have them, you know, say that they're in the same character.
Or I mean, connected. Why do people think that they're in like reverse chronological order?
I don't know. That's what I'm looking right now, but I think it's because, yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's because people obviously put the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly first, because it's the Civil War. It takes place during
that. Oh, so it's historical.
So I think it just is around that. But that's really the only thing that they base it off of. And I think they mean like, you know, El Paso and all these other things wouldn't look like that pre or during the Civil War.
Right. And the Civil War would have played more into the plot of the movie, possibly.
Yeah.
Like it does in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah. So I don't know. But yeah, for A Few Dollars More, yeah, it takes place after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And then, yeah.
So let me ask you this question. Which one do you like better?
I think I personally like A Few Dollars More.
I'm like on the fence. I really did like Fistful of Dollars a lot. And I didn't know what to expect with this movie, but I liked this. But I think I might give the upper hand a little bit to A Fistful of Dollars.
Well, that's all right. But what would make it better? Because, I mean, it's really just personal preference on what you think. Because they're really a little bit different.
I think that it's more like I just preferred the story that was a little bit more self-contained. And I liked Clint Eastwood's character in the first movie. Not that I didn't like it in this movie, but I felt like the Lee Van Cleef character kind of divided the attention from what did they call him? From Joe, I guess, or Blondie, or whatever you want to call him, or Mancho. That wasn't necessarily bad, because I did think Lee Van Cleef was very good, but there was something about Fistful of Dollars that, like, combining the soundtrack and everything just felt very special. So I think, like, it's more of a personal thing. I could understand an argument. I also think like this plot got a little bit more confusing, and so I like that it was complex and it went new places, but it was nice to have like that very simple plot that, even though since it's so cheap, it was probably a little confusing.
So you think they can do more with less?
Yeah. Maybe. Okay. I tend to be a more with less person. Yeah. It'd be kind of like if you liked Reservoir Dogs more than Pulp Fiction, which I'm not sure that I actually do, but it's kind of like...
That's tough.
Yeah, because Reservoir Dogs is much more simple, even though it still has some like reverse chronological stuff. Whereas Pulp Fiction gets
Pulp Fiction is just masterful, though. It's beautiful.
But that would be like the comparison. Or if you like, or like something like, I like Memento is my favorite Christopher Nolan movie.
Rather than his more
complex stories. So it tends to be where I find like a lot of beauty in how directors, when they're so like, they have so many constraints and they still make something great out of it. Sometimes when you give them a lot, which it wasn't necessarily like Sergio Leone was working with a lot in this movie, but he was working with more. Sure. Like sometimes the result isn't necessarily better, although I think it's a pretty close matchup.
Sure, sure. And just a real quick side tangent. So according to Screen Rant, we don't know, you know, how reliable this is, but
oh, it's super reliable.
Once we watch this third movie, you've seen the third movie, but by the end of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, he assembles his iconic poncho suit.
So, oh, okay.
So they think that that's why, and the Civil War is there, so that's why they think it's first. And then they think for a few dollars more it takes place. They think that it takes place before A Fistful of Dollars because Manco and Mortimer engaged in the bravado shooting contest where the target is the man with no name's hat. The holes from that squabble can be seen in A Fistful of Dollars.
Oh my.
Interesting.
That is very interesting because that would mean that Sergio Leone actually
thought about that.
Well, he maybe had just like made the hat in the first movie and said, this is from some vague shooting that he had been in. But now then he was like, okay, I'm going to assign this some meaning. But it's hard to know whether he actually did that or not. But it's for those who pay very close attention, it's a kind of interesting argument.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the only inconsistencies are obviously the name of the man with no name. And that's probably why they call him the man with no name.
Yeah, but he never refers to himself by anything.
No, he doesn't.
So
you're right. He could just be doing alter egos.
So that, I don't think that's as much of a, I think it's the same guy. But it's like one of those TV shows where they keep restarting and like nothing is consistent. Like it's like they didn't remember the last episode type thing.
Yeah.
But I think if you were really creative, you could probably try to make a way that it all is all consistent and fits together.
Yeah.
Other than you'd have to excuse that they reuse actors and put them in different roles that wouldn't make any sense.
But also the Mortimer character, isn't he bad in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So and, like,
yeah.
I don't know.
That's what I'm saying.
Character arcs just don't fit.
Well, he can't be the same guy. So you either have to say, I'm looking at this as the same actor, but a different character. Or you have to make some sort of weird, like, they were twins or some really strange connection. I think you can just say they were the same actor, but like in the world of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and the other movies, he's a different person.
Okay. Interesting. No, I think it's fine. I don't think it makes it ingenuine when you have different actors playing or the same actors playing different characters.
No, I don't think they do it very often anymore, but this was also a very low budget movie, so
very low. And Clint got more money for this, right?
Yeah, Clint got $50,000.
Oh, good.
Upping from his $15,000, and then Van Cleef got $17,000, which I don't know whether that was satisfactory. I'm sure he got more in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That seems to be how it works. Charles Bronson was supposed to be, they wanted him for this role. So they were ready to kick, Clint Eastwood to the curb.
Really?
Yeah. But, he I guess was not convinced. I'm not really that familiar with Charles Bronson, but apparently he was a big deal because in his Wikipedia article, it says by the like early 70s, he was making like $1 million per film, which in the 70s seems like would be a lot of money.
Yeah, that's true.
Was he one of the
people in that town at the end? He kind of looks familiar.
I don't know, because I don't think he was in it at all. But he was in, like, he was in The Magnificent Seven as one of the lead roles.
Okay.
And then he was in, eventually he was in Once Upon a Time in the West, which is a Sergio Leone movie. Yeah. So eventually he did make it in. And so I guess Clint Eastwood can be thankful that Charles Bronson turned it down because these movies were the things that made him famous. And if he hadn't gotten to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is, I think, clearly the most famous of the three, like, most people wouldn't necessarily recognize these first two movies if they weren't familiar with spaghetti westerns, but a lot of people would recognize The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, even if they didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
Like, just because of the name. It's a very memorable title, and it has its plot structure is similar.
Yeah.
I mean, SpaghettiWestern.net has The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as the number one spaghetti western movie. Then Once Upon a Time in the West is number two. And For a Few Dollars More is number three. And let's see, where Fistful of Dollars is number six. So Sergio Leone was dominant. I think Django is another one that's now people, but they know Django Unchained, which is the Tarantino movie. But there wasn't a Django movie by Sergio Corbucci in 1966.
Sergio just knew how to do it.
Yeah, it was a lot of Sergios.
Interesting.
Corbucci, Leone. There's a different Sergio. Sergio Solima.
Directed Face to Face.
Yeah, so.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting. I mean, it might be an interesting genre to explore if you like it, because like there's some that like there's this movie called Return of Ringo, and it's just like it follows the Odyssey, except for it's about like a guy returning from Civil War and having to reclaim his house. Like, so they do that sort of thing in spaghetti westerns.
Interesting.
And there's a whole forum dedicated to it that you can read all about tons of things.
Can you read one of them?
Yeah. So, Lanky Gunman, with a underscore in between those words, said, I rewatch it now, and I got a question. Something puzzled me. In the middle of the movie, when Clint Eastwood arrived in the Mexican band... Wait. This isn't the one that I... No, this is. This is. He arrived in the Mexican band after he set free another bandito. Then Gian Maria Valente explained his plan, and Eastwood said he prefer yeah, I know, going to sleep before a gunfight. At this time, the music stopped suddenly, and for a few seconds, a black screen appeared, and the movie restart when Eastwood is with three members of the gang. The version I saw is the French release of the movie. So my question is, there a cut? So wait,
did they cut something out?
Yeah, did they cut something out, or is there other versions like Great Britain, maybe, or whatever FFDM stands for? Or yeah, for a few dollars more, like GBU. Many
good, the bad, and the ugly.
Oh, okay.
Great Britain. That's funny.
I was making leaps. I should have known that based on the way the person wrote that. No, I was not going to be able to understand.
No, I'm first. That's a good question, because those cuts were very weird.
That, especially that cut.
Wait, read the next one. Okay,
the next one. Just popped my German special edition into my player. It is the same thing. Before you mentioned it, it didn't occur to me that the music stopped, but now it's very obvious. But the scene had a clear end with Eastwood going to sleep. But the music ends indeed quite harshly. Again, we have to wait for Sergio to come back to the forum and answer this question.
He's been on the forum.
Wait, has Sergio Leone been on this forum?
Interesting.
That I might have to do some more research into this forum.
Wait, Lanky responded again.
Yep, thank for answer. This guy doesn't know how to use like S's in this. He's probably, I would guess, not. He's probably not English. English is probably not his first language. But Lanky Gunman, if you'd love to come on the podcast, or if you'd like to come on the podcast, we'd love to have you on. I'd love to know all of your knowledge about spaghetti westerns.
It's probably a lot. I mean, he's...
Yeah.
Wow.
And the latest forum post was 8 days ago, so this forum is still active.
Who is it?
And it was Cuchillo Sanchez.
Sanchez.
Hello, everyone. I just created an account. In my opinion, Leone's second western is also his second best, right behind... She, of course, used the Italian name for the movie, and I don't know what it is. Sierra Una Volte. Van Cleef as Douglas Mortimer, Eastwood as the man with no name, even though he is Manco/Manco, and Volante as the sadistic El Indio. It features plenty of memorable supporting characters like the Prophet, Groggy, and Nino, and is just so rewatchable, with a beautiful score by Morricone being the icing on the cake. Just my opinion. Best regards to everyone. Roland.
Thank you, Roland.
That pretty much sums
it up.
Let's
start an account after this.
Yeah, we should. We should start it and sign it as the Movie Vault.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, we got to find a way to get listeners. We got to get creative. This is going to be our method. We're going to find a forum for every movie that we watch. And we're just going to post episodes about the episodes.
Or make some friends.
Yeah, make some friends along the way.
We'll make some friends with Lanky Man.
Yeah, Lanky Gunman.
Lanky Gunman.
We should, like, reply to his post from, like, however many...
And find out where
he lives. That was so many years ago. That was almost 20 years ago at this point.
That he posted that?
Yeah, 2006.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's, like, 17 years ago.
Let's say, hey, I just read your comment. Sorry for the late response. let's make our profile Sergio Leone. And say, hey, sorry for the late response. I just saw this. But yeah, I have a different version that I keep for myself. For $500, you can have it. Please Venmo me.
Please
Venmo me at Zach Leibold. That's my assistant.
And we'll ship that to you right away.
Yeah. So give us your address also.
Yeah.
Or we could do direct deposit or direct take from your account and just give us
or just leave cash at this address.
Yeah.
But Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah.
What do you think about him?
I thought that he was excellent. Really, I did.
Clarence Leroy Van Cleef Jr. He's an American actor. So they brought over an American for this.
Yeah.
Another one.
And one thing that I think we both mentioned from the first film was that we felt like the acting was not the best from the non-Clint Eastwood people.
No, I even... To be honest, I mean, Clint didn't give like a deep performance.
No, even Clint was maybe not even the greatest, but I think Lee Van Cleef adds another like strong performance. And I think Gian Maria Volente is also good just because of his like craziness. Yeah. Like maybe other people can play crazy people better, but it was pretty good. Beyond that, though, I think it falls off significantly. And it's not even like the people leading the film are like the greatest talents.
But Clarence Leroy Van Cleef Jr. added something to it.
Yeah. He added some suaveness. I love that word. I use that word to describe the man with no name in the last episode. He added some elder statesmanliness.
Sure. I think he had some maturity and some.
Yeah, that's a good word.
You know, he brought down Joe. He brought him, Manco, whatever. He brought him down a notch, which was nice.
Yeah. And he has that smile, you know.
Yeah, his teeth are ingrained in my mind right now.
Yeah, so
they're not bad.
So, and then we're gonna get to see him as a villain. So we'll get to see both sides of him: him as a hero-ish, revenge type guy, and him as a villain. I think honestly, I might give the upper hand to him in this movie.
What does that mean?
As like. Having the better performance.
Than Clint. Okay.
Yeah. I think Clint is probably ultimately in the whole grand scheme of things more memorable because he's the man with no name and he's the thing tying all the movies together. But his performance is, I mean, Lee Van Cleef was pretty good in this.
Yeah.
And Clint Eastwood was honestly kind of second fiddle in a lot of parts.
You're definitely right, yeah.
So
this was his story, if you think about it.
It almost felt more like this was a story about Douglas Mortimer than it was about Manco.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is his story. I thought about that.
So I think initially I was like, yeah, of course I would think Eastwood is better, but now I'm not really sure whether I would actually consider that to be the case.
But are you saying better acting or character or what?
Maybe even better acting in this movie.
Sure. I haven't seen Clint in many things. That's the thing. It's hard to compare for me.
I'm just comparing him in this movie.
Sure.
Not necessarily overall career, because again, you're right. I haven't seen Clint in as many stuff after. I've definitely not seen Lee Van Cleef in anything besides Sergio Leone films.
Yeah. So, I'm not trying to disagree with you. I think you might be right, because he actually had the story arc of, you know, he had the backstory and he had the mystery. He had the introduction and then he had the closing argument pretty much.
And I suppose acting kind of comes down to what do you do with the role that you're given? Like, how do you make people remember you? And I think although like more screen time is given to Manco overall, I think you remember Mortimer and you get to see, and there's like just some more depth to him. That I guess like Clint Eastwood wasn't necessarily given because his character is supposed to be mysterious. But yeah, it works well. Ultimately, probably doesn't really matter who is better. They were both pretty good.
Yeah.
So
you're definitely right.
It's just an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah. No, yeah. And another thing that added to this is just their dynamic. I mean, like I said, there wasn't really a dynamic there, but you have this elderly statesman-like suaveness person, and you have the young cocky, you know, cowboy, and you know him kind of getting shown up in the first duel that they have, where they're shooting each other's hats. You know, Clint can only shoot his hat so far before he misses, and then the other guy, Clarence Leroy Van Cleef Jr., can shoot it as far as he can. It just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going.
Yeah.
Doesn't miss. So right off the bat, you're like, okay, this guy's better. Which is it's a different position than we had in the first film, as we said. But it's great to see, because not only that, but you're not only seeing a different side of Clint's character, but you're seeing a new character who is, you know, who's not only, he's not prideful, he's not outgoing, he's pretty humble about what he does, but he like asserts his dominance in the first scene. and he knows why he's there. So he's almost the one that's in charge of every situation, even though that one situation when they're climbing down the wall and the guys are there to catch them. But still, it's like, yeah, I think his character adds a lot more to this film than Clint Eastwood's character, to be honest.
So, yeah. So and of course, right. It's all tied together by Ennio Morricone's fabulous soundtrack.
Yeah.
And the additional side effects that are amazing.
Boy, yeah.
Which I don't know whether Morricone had anything to do with that, or that was all Sergio Leone.
And one thing that we thought about, like, how did they do some of those practical effects? Like a horse just falling over? Like, that, did they actually shoot a horse?
I'm sure the people of the Spaghetti Western Forum could let us know.
True, they're the experts of this.
Yeah, we'll see. And we have a question.
But no, the practical effects were great. You know, the horses are always great. There weren't as many long riding horse scenes in this compared to the first one. I think the gunshots were good. You know, they're shooting the apples or whatever out of the tree. Those were cool. You could tell, like, the camera was stopping and then it would drop. And the camera would stop and then it would drop again. And, yeah, the big standout, though, was the Prophet.
Yeah.
I forget the actor's name, but he played – who did he play in the first one again?
He was the – I don't know what his name was, but he had all the caskets.
That's right. He's the casket guy. And this
– Joseph Egger.
They hype up his character so much more. They make him this crazy guy who's just yelling and yelling and yelling and obsessed with trains, as we said. But then actually knows like what he's talking about too. He's like, yeah. Oh yeah, the guy who keeps his gun right this, you should have just asked that, you know? Yeah. But no, he was excellent. And his facial expressions were hilarious. He's like biting his upper lip because he's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just like, I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's perfect for the role though.
He would be a perfect prospector. I just thought
of prospector. Well, maybe the prospector is based on him.
I know he's dead, but if they did a live action Toy Story 2, he should be the prospector. Yeah. That would be awesome. But this was his last film, correct?
Yes, it was his very last film.
So last performance, he did an amazing job and he stuck out. And I won't really forget him because it was kind of a little bit disturbing when he talked about those things. But yeah, I'm looking at the prospector. He could definitely be the prospector.
I was trying to figure out whether they say where they get the idea for the prospector from. But they don't really on Pixar Wiki.
There's a forum for everything.
I know. There really is. Yeah, so... I don't know how much there really is to say more about For a Few Dollars More. I haven't really given Westerns too much of an like, I don't even know how many Westerns I've seen. Not that all that many. But there is something, like, really nice about the genre. And I get that, like, there's a lot of conventions. But the nice thing about genre films is that you can always, like, twist conventions, do different things, which is what the Spaghetti Western directors were doing. I'll have to go back and watch some of the more notable Westerns from the past, such as like Stagecoach, and a lot of like the John Ford movies, 3:10 to Yuma, The Magnificent Seven, of course. I of course like some neo westerns, like the newer westerns that have come out, like There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And another one that's really good that's a neo western is Hell or High Water. So it's a genre that hasn't exactly disappeared, although it would probably be tough to find a movie that's new that feels like these movies from the 60s, but that's probably okay. Like, there's tons. I mean, I think pretty sure there's hundreds and thousands, maybe if not thousands, of Western movies from the 50s and 60s that you go back. So you would never really run out.
Yeah. And like I said in the last episode, you know, you get glimpses of that in some shows, like in movies. Like we talked about The Mandalorian. That's the big one that's on right now. But I can tell. Now when I watch it, I'm not going to be able to unsee it, you know?
So yeah.
Just even like the way that the soundtrack is designed, it's not like a big orchestra, you know? It's whistling. It's like a piano sometimes, guitar. Yeah. So it's like it really is limited in its accompaniment, which is good. I think it works to its advantage because that's like, I don't know. It like makes it seem bare, which is good. For some reason, it's feeling bare naked, and it feels good for some reason. You know? Like this film, You know, you're just, it's nature. It's the sun. You're just out there, you know? So, yeah, there are drum beats in the background and people trying to kill you, but yeah, it's just what it is. So I think, I don't know, like, why would it be different than any other film before? Why would it be different than, before, like, what makes spaghetti westerns so unique? I don't know, but it's probably like the style or the atmosphere.
Yeah,
that's what you usually say, but I don't know. I was trying to figure that out watching this and thinking about it before after A Fistful of Dollars, but it's tough to discern. But I think it's a combination of many different things. What is it you said?
It's a subgenre. It, according to Game Rant, which it cannot be in any way associated with Screen Rant, I'm sure. it's a subgenre that's defined by its rougher, bloodier vision of the West. So, and I think that makes sense. We talked about how the man with no name feels more like an anti-hero, or at least neutral, not really a hero, not really a villain, in between. Whereas I think the older Westerns from the 50s, especially in the U.S., tended to create clear good and bad. And so that might have been one of the more plot-driven ways that spaghetti westerns differentiated themselves. They also may have been more violent. I'm not positive, yeah. But it's not even like they were that violent. But even seeing like a bullet hole in someone's head, they might have not had something like that in some of the earlier Western films.
It's like The Walking Dead back then.
That would have been too intense, and you got to think some of the Westerns were like more like families could go watch them, whereas these ones had a little bit more adult content,
mm-hmm.
in terms of just being like a little bit darker. Obviously, this film you should not show to kids.
No, probably not. But along with that, I think they're probably, with the darkness comes more drama. I think it's more dramatic and thematic, maybe even more cinematic.
Yeah.
Like, it's telling an overarching theme as well, not just like a story of good and bad. It's like, I don't know, they walk away into the sunset. I feel like that's very common in these, you know? That happened in both of these films so far. We'll see if it happens again.
Yeah. And in the Wikipedia article, they describe it as demythologizing. I don't even know that's a word. They demythologized. I'm definitely not pronouncing that right.
Demythologized
the conventions of the U.S. Westerns. And that just comes from like sort of an outsider perspective. Like, this is someone who's not from the U.S., who is watching films from the U.S. and saying, I'm going to make that, but I'm making it from the perspective of a European. And however that changes your lens of how you make a Western.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it became popular here.
Yeah. Yeah, eventually. They did become
popular. It was popular in Italy first, probably. That's where they released it first. Yeah. And then it became popular in France.
Maybe didn't even intend for
the U.S. audience.
The U.S. audience to love it.
Yeah. I think that's a fair assessment, but yeah, I mean, they really are popular in many, many countries. And I think, you know, they got American actors to play in these Italian lensed films of the American Western film genre. But I think you could have done it. I don't think it really mattered who was in the main character. I think it was the style of the film that may have stuck out. I don't think it was like they have Clint Eastwood, so that made it, you know, great. I think it really was Sergio Leone in every single part of it. And Marconi or whatever his name is. I forget his name.
And really it kind of died after the 1970s. And then the only way that I can think that it's been brought to the forefront is in Django Unchained, which is Quentin Tarantino's Western revenge fantasy movie with Jamie Foxx. And
what is it? What?
It's like a revenge fantasy.
Uh-huh.
Type thing. So it does kind of actually, in a lot of ways, you can see some parts of For a Few Dollars More.
Hmm.
I mean, vaguely, not very closely, but it obviously tackles a different angle as it's more based in the American South, although there is a trip to the West that's involved in Django Unchained. But other than that, and which, of course, Quentin Tarantino would be into this.
True.
Like, he's into this, like, 70s B-tier movies and, like, random action movies. Like, really, objectively, probably some lower quality films, but he was able to turn them into something. I don't know. I feel like we always end up talking about Quentin Tarantino, or I at least do.
You do.
When it comes to this. I already referenced Reservoir Dogs in this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's something to, I don't, like, not everything has to be like a metaphysical study or like use a complex math equation to make a story plot or do any of that. There's lots of different ways to make a good movie. And I think watching these movies just shows that.
Yeah, and that's how it started.
Yeah.
We just got carried away. They just got carried away. I'm not part of them.
Yeah. When we make our movie.
Oh, yeah. Our original idea.
Nobody will accuse us of trying to do something that is too complicated, but also they won't know where we got the ideas from.
True. Well, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. One day.
One day.
Directed by Zach and Ben, or Ben and Zach, whatever you want. And Quentin Tarantino.
And Quentin Tarantino produced.
Yeah.
All right. With that, do you want to close
with
this?
With that.
You want to close this thing up?
Yeah. Great film. I'm looking forward to the third, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. So
yeah.
That one's like 3 hours long.
Yep.
So we'll do that when you're back in town, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it will be, I've seen it before.
Okay.
And it's good.
Well, that's you'll have a long plane ride ahead of you. So.
That's true. I maybe should download it for the way back.
You should.
That would be the efficient way to do things.
Yep. All right. All right. With that, I'll shoot us out.
Yep. Sounds good.
All right. See ya.